Just to let folks know, I am going to be leaving a couple minutes early today. I apologize for that, but every 2 years or so, I have to end the class early. it is very strange at times to think that I've been doing this every Tuesday and Friday. There have been a few times when my friends have kindly filled in for me, but showing up, consistency is so key to Dharma practice, and especially to recovery. As I like to point out, if we want to tell people about our recovery, the thing we usually tell them is how long we've been sober or working, in our program, as opposed to saying how well we've done it. Like, I've only been sober for, a little while, but man, I've done such a great job working the steps, I get extra points. Whereas, I've been sober for 36 years and, my life has been chaos, but I'm still viewed as a success. You know what I'm saying? So, and I feel the same way about Dharma practice. I've been practicing for a long time and I've had a lot of bad meditations. I've kept showing up day by day. So we're going to meditate first, and then we're going to talk about Dharma and so-called God. But let's start with the sit. I'm going to mute all. Nothing personal. Anyway, welcome everybody before I start. It's nice to see people. It looks like some names that I'm not familiar with, so I'll either take that to mean that I don't always notice everybody, or sometimes new people come. So you are all very welcome here. Thank you for being here and taking care of yourself in this way this morning or this evening or whatever time of day it is for you. All right, beginning by coming into a comfortable meditation posture, holding yourself erect, as the Buddha says, although you are also invited to lie down if you need to do so. Any posture is workable for mindfulness practice. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, moving out of the visual world, the external world, into the inner life, the sense life felt through the body to begin. So just feeling how you're holding your body. We're immediately aware of our relationship to our body. And you might notice that there can be a certain struggle even to just feel comfortable about being in a body. So many of us are self-conscious about our bodies, or if we're disconnected from our bodies and we tune into them, it can be almost an alien experience. What are these sensations? Just breathing and feeling yourself sitting here, sitting there, no sense of your own environment, whether there are sounds nearby or the air and the space you're in. One of the unique things of this era is that we each meditate in our own private or separate space. So it's different for each of us, not like sharing a meditation hall. So notice just how you feel in this space. Are you comfortable here? Do you feel safe? Hopefully you feel at ease. And feeling the breath just moving in the body. And the breath can be felt in a range of places. It's really moving through quite a lot of the body, from the nostrils, then the throat, and filling the lungs, moving the chest, moving the belly, the back, all expand and contract. So as you feel the breath, also take note of the more emotional or subtle feelings. These can be felt through the breath or with the breath. And when there are difficult feelings present, such a tendency for us to turn away or try to suppress. But with mindfulness practice, it's much more skillful to turn toward, open to, and breathe with difficult feelings, having a sense of them as energies that are moving through the body, moving through the mind. So as we breathe, we also soften the body. A sense of releasing. So again, we are kind of moving in the other direction from the tendency to armor ourselves, to protect ourselves. We're opening the body, opening the heart. So there's a quality of receptiveness, just receiving our present moment experience, not controlling it. To do this, we need a certain amount of trust that we'll be okay if we let everything wash through us. We won't be overwhelmed by our feelings, our thoughts, or our sensations. The breath then becomes our anchor, in some sense, our refuge. Keeps us right here in this present moment. We can start to focus more closely on sensations of breath. We can follow the breath at the nostrils, the touch of air coming in and out. Or if you prefer, you can feel the body in the belly or the chest, or you feel the breath in the body, in the belly or the chest, just the movement, the rising and falling. The breath is very useful because it's always here. It's always moving. So it requires us to stay with it. It's not a static thing. We follow the changing sensations of breath. But it also is essentially a neutral experience, not something that is terribly pleasurable or terribly uncomfortable. So it doesn't sort of trigger typically. So just being with that neutral experience helps our mind and body to move into a more neutral state, which can then evolve into calm and comfort, a peacefulness. Mm-hmm. It's natural for the mind to wander. To take us away from the breath in the present moment. So integral to our practice is returning. Coming back to the breath. Letting go of thought. Not fighting with thoughts, not judging thoughts, not analyzing thoughts, just seeing them, knowing them, and returning over and over. Notice how your experience keeps changing as you sit. We might start to feel quieter, and then maybe the mind gets busy or get very relaxed, and then there's some discomfort that comes. So sitting with change, the openness, and allowing, without expectation. This is our practice. All right. Nice to sit. And I imagine some of you just come for that, which I can appreciate. I wanted to mention for anybody who might be in the neighborhood, that going to do some live teaching in London on July 30th with my friend Vince Cullen. Going to teach a day long for London Insight. have to put it up on my website. But if we have any of our UK visitors here, maybe put that on your calendar. Great to go. London Insight's been very kind to me over the years. I've visited there a couple of times and people show up. It's nice. And they're generous. London's great too, although I haven't been there since Brexit. Anyway, let's move on. somebody is arriving late. So we have been going through, just started going through my book, Burning Desire, Dharma God and the Path of Recovery. And so I'm just reading little pieces of it and talking about it just as a kind of way to set off conversations. I'm on page 17 for those who are reading along at home. In the section, we're right about to get into the different higher powers. So this is the last part of the kind of introduction to the section called Dharma God. And in the previous section, I talked about different Buddhist teachers, and in fact, all of them were monks, and sort of things they said about the idea of God, ranging from Ajahn Amaro saying Buddhism is all about God, and Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who kind of calls the Dharma God. It's where I really got that concept of Dharma God from Buddhadasa. And then from them, ranging all the way to Wapola Rahula, who, you know, essentially says, like, you know, in Buddhism, we don't believe in God, which is kind of the conventional way of thinking about Buddhism. It's one of the things that I think draws Westerners to Buddhism, is the sense, okay, I don't have to have a belief in some magical being and all of that. And I can certainly appreciate that. And so, you know, I guess what I'm doing here is essentially redefining the word God and more precisely trying to fit the Dharma in with the 12 steps. And you know, it's very possible, had I never encountered the 12 steps, and if that wasn't something I'd had to do, that I would have kind of remained pretty much agnostic or atheist. But, you know, the 12 steps kind of challenge us with their theistic language. And then, you know, as a Buddhist practitioner, a Dharma student, you know, it seemed that I needed to make some sense of this. This goes back 30 years to when this process began for me. So let me pick up this last section here. So when Ajahn Amaro says Buddhism is all about God, and Ajahn Buddhadasa talks about a Dharma God, what do they mean? For the skeptic, there needs to be some explanation of this idea. And for the religious person who might feel that his or her beliefs are being taken away, there needs to be some replacement, some new way of holding the God concept. Dharma is at the heart of this new understanding. Like many words coming out of the Buddhist tradition, its meaning is complex, layered, and even at times paradoxical. As I've said, it can, first of all, be understood as truth. Ajahn Chah defines Dharma as the truth of the way things are. This gets a little closer to referring to the workings of the universe, not so much the physical laws, though these would be included, but what we would call spiritual laws. The reason these laws can be called higher power or even God is that, like the traditional concept of God, they are unseen forces at work behind all of existence. They are truths that we are powerless over. They rule our lives, whether we are aware of them or not. And perhaps more importantly, when we live in harmony with them, we reap the fruits of happiness and freedom. Buddhadasa talks about four aspects of Dharma God. First is nature itself, which is clearly more powerful than us. From a Dharma perspective, besides what we typically call nature, this includes fundamental truths like impermanence and suffering, dukkha. The second aspect is the laws of nature, which we either work with or against, like the law of karma, which actually becomes the first, like higher power that I talk about. Buddhadasa calls the third aspect of God the duty of humans according to the law of nature. This is the kind of power that we can cultivate ourselves, like the powers of mindfulness, of loving kindness, and the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path. These three types of powers and our relationship to them are embodied in the Serenity Prayer, which asks for, quote, the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. We accept things, trusting in God, but we also take responsibility for our role in things. Higher power isn't all about God having power over us. It's also about us developing power in ourselves, wholesome power, the power for good. Buddhadasa refers to the fourth aspect of God as the, quote, fruits that human beings receive according to the law of nature. These fruits can be as significant as a full-blown spiritual awakening or enlightenment experience, or as simple as the ease that comes from a moment of letting go of fear, sadness, or anger. In another example, the power of the truth of not self is in the fruits of seeing it. When we have a deep realization that ego is an illusion, our experience of life changes in powerful ways. So, I'm kind of dipping into things here that get much more elaborated in later parts, and just in case you think like this is coming at you too fast. Dharma God is considered to be an impersonal power. There's no being behind this power. No one is watching over you. We talk about how there is nothing personal about suffering or impermanence or karma. They are powers that affect everyone equally. Dharma God doesn't like you or dislike you. And yet, in another way, Dharma God can be seen as intensely personal. What is more personal than your karma? Mindfulness is right here with you. You can't get closer or more personal than the breath. Loving kindness touches and opens our heart in the most intimate way. Intention lives deep within us. Suffering and impermanence touch us directly. There's nothing impersonal about any of these aspects of the Dharma. They are affecting our lives in every moment in a very real way. In fact, while the idea of a supreme being may sound personal, a distant, unknowable God seems more impersonal to me than a God I can experience here and now in all these ways. Because the meaning of Dharma is layered and its role as higher power is complex, it will be helpful if you keep all these perspectives in mind as we explore a variety of Buddhist teachings. Okay, then. So that you know, it's a short section. It seems to me that it contains a bunch of useful things. You know, first of all, just this word Dharma, people often ask what it means. And yet, you know, it has sort of different meanings in Buddhism. It has a generic meaning, actually. Sometimes just means phenomena. But usually when we talk about the Dharma, what we really are talking about is the teachings of the Buddha, which by definition are true, right? So truth and the Dharma become synonyms, but it has this larger meaning too of kind of truth and ultimate truth. And so it kind of, you know, to say Dharma is God or God is Dharma doesn't really tell us very much. You know, it seems like a too much shorthand. And so that's why I wrote the book. That kind of becomes the driving question in the book. What how is Dharma God? And more specifically, and this is something I realized as I was writing the book, more specifically, what I really want to answer the question is, how do we turn our will and our lives over to the care of Dharma? So it really became almost a book about the third step. And I didn't really realize that when I began writing, but that was the question that kept coming back to me, that kept informing the work I was doing. And you'll see that as we go through these different things we call higher powers in here. So a couple more comments about this. One is to say that, you know, Buddhadasa giving these four aspects of Dharma God, you can actually hear or sense the resonance of the Four Noble Truths in his description of Dharma God. And that's typical of a Buddhist teacher and typical of the Buddha and typical of Buddhadasa. Buddhadasa, if you don't know, was a 20th century Thai Buddhist master who was somewhat of an iconoclast. And like his, and this is a great example of that, most Buddhists, probably most Thai Buddhists, will not say equate Dharma and God, but this was his, he put this stamp on this idea. So I also don't want you to get the idea that, Buddhists think that Dharma is God. It's not, I'm making that claim that we can use Dharma in the place of God in its role in the steps and maybe in other ways. But I don't want to confuse you and get you in trouble when you go to a Buddhist center and say, oh, so Dharma is God, right? Some Zen teacher is going to get out a stick and whack you. You know, probably not really, but you know, you get the idea. So, this is a fringe idea, let's say. But then again, you know, as addicts, we are fringe members of the Buddhist community anyway. I like to think of myself as being persecuted, you know, a victim at all times. So, this argument I make here about the personal versus the impersonal was very intentional, and because I'd had multiple people sort of express some distress about this, like, oh, but you know, I really, you know, I feel like I need a personal God that I can talk to, you know, and that somehow this image of God as being sort of human-like or anthropomorphizing God helped them in their, I don't know, prayers or in their concept. And so so I just was kind of, you know, countering that with this idea, like, well, isn't your karma really, really personal? And isn't mindfulness, you know, very personal? These are, and I do believe that it's not just something I was trying to, you know, get into a debate about, but I really do believe that this connection of turning these dharmic, these ideas from the Dharma into, you know, thinking of them as powers, that it does give us a connection that's very real and very immediate. Now, I'll also say that in those moments when I, you know, there are moments when I feel a need for, I don't find myself wanting to call upon God But I find myself wanting to call upon perhaps Kuan Yin, you know, or some sort of guardian spirit or bodhisattva. So if I get into like a, if you want to call it personal, like praying to some being or to some, you know, praying for some intercession, or particularly what I typically pray for is care, you know, to sort of, to, and it's really for me about self-compassion. It's about connecting with, you know, a sense of being cared for. And so that gets embodied in sort of a bodhisattva, or, you know, Virgin Mary is also, you know, I consider the Virgin Mary to really be essentially a bodhisattva, really Kuan Yin. I sort of think they're the same thing, but ultimately, if I analyze that, because I can't help it, you know, my intellect wants to like, well, what's that really mean? What I come to is that I have this energy, or refuge within myself. I have this caringness within myself, that when I feel distressed, I can kind of breathe and soften and call to that, or reach out to that. You know, when my mind is like wanting to get into conflict or fear, and, you know, different emotions that are, you know, agitating, that I can also kind of like breathe and remember, oh yes, but there's also that okayness, I'm okay. And so that's where I connect with what I think people mean by a personal relationship with a higher power. But again, I don't really see it as outside myself. So, you know, I don't know if this is, you know, an issue for people who just are just atheists and just sort of like, I don't need that. I completely respect that. You know, I just would like, you know, I feel a responsibility, I guess, to speak to the and support the recovery community. And because so many people have come to the 12 steps and felt alienated by immediately being like, oh, but I don't believe in God, and they're telling me I have to turn my life over to God. What am I supposed to do? You know, so obviously, like, the refuge recovery dharma approach was to just sort of throw out the 12 steps and sort of start again. I got sober with the 12 steps. At least that was an integral part of the process. I don't really think this 12 steps, certainly the 12 steps didn't get me sober, you know, but they were integral to my recovery. And so the idea of throwing them out and starting again with Buddhism, my problem with that was that though 12 steps worked for me as a recovery program, and Buddhism didn't work for me as a recovery program. It works for me as an integral part of my recovery program, but that's not where I started. You know, I did Buddhist practice before I got sober, and the fifth precept was there all along, saying you weren't supposed to drink, and I ignored it, you know, like a lot of other people. And so it didn't have the sort of same impact of like, I'm an alcoholic and I need to do the thing that alcoholics do. You know, let me try that. 'Cause my life's not working. And so then it came to like, okay, I got this God thing. And at that point in my life, I was not, you know, my spiritual beliefs were way like untethered, you know, they were not like clearly stated in my mind. They're very wide open. And so I was okay with just going along with God for a while until I kind of came back to a more Buddhist view. And then at 6-7 years sober, that's when it became an issue. That wasn't an issue like, oh, I'm going to drink or use, or I'm going to leave the program. It just was like, oh, I want to sort this out. And that's how that process began for me. So I imagine each of you has your own story, as we do. As there used to be a TV show called The Naked City about New York. And they would say, there are 8 million stories in The Naked City. So there are 43 stories in this group this morning. So maybe some others would like to share about their kind of process here a little bit, or whatever you want to bring up. I'll open it up. Oh, hello, Jonathan. Nice to see you.
Good morning. Good morning, Kevin. Yeah, hey. I got some thoughts, maybe some questions even. We'll see if I can spit them out. I guess what you were just saying, like, it was really speaking to me about the idea of like not self and like the personalized higher power. And like, to me, like right in this moment, it's seeming like if I have like this deep belief in life as a personal experience, then like that would, like the corollary might seem then that I need this personal God. But if I'm like really connected to the idea that none of this shit's personal, then like, why would there be then, right? Like then
it just feels like,
again, a total corollary for me. I guess the question I had for you was about and is connected to the idea of not self as well. I'm like doing forgiveness meditation a lot lately, because like it's, you know, ever needed for me as a resentful, deeply resentful person. But I'm thinking about a lot about how like it seems like it's getting harder and harder to parse apart like whether it's even like me or the other person that needs forgiveness. And I'm like not sure if that's as a result of my like dissolving of the self or confusion, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think no matter what we think needs to be forgiven, we're doing forgiveness practice for ourselves. So, you know, as a practice, to me, it's about encountering our lack of self-forgiveness, our self-judgment, and bringing compassion to that, and bringing understanding to that, the realization that, you know, imperfection is human, that we must, that it's inevitable that we do some harm, and that doesn't make us, you know, unworthy or deserving of punishment. And so to me, that's the heart of it, is like confronting and dealing with and learning to hold those thoughts and feelings and changing my perspective on them. Everyone needs forgiveness since everyone is imperfect. So certainly other people need to be forgiven. But again, we can't really forgive them, you know, beyond our own thoughts about them, our own feelings about them. And what's the true motivation for that? I mean, our forgiveness doesn't change their karma. Let's put it that way, right? you know, that's a truism about karma, that everybody has their own karma, and no one can affect anyone else's karma, you know, in an at least in the sort of absolute and traditional sense, that we can mess up other people's lives, of course, but that's not quite the same. But so again, forgiveness of self and forgiveness of other is ultimately the same thing, because it's confronting our internal experience and it's confronting our judgment, whether it's judging self or judging other. It's the same thing, whether it's anger or hatred towards self or other. It's the same thing. And at the heart of it is seeing that suffering arises through judgment, through hatred, through anger. And so we forgive not because we, you know, think that someone deserves it, or even necessarily we deserve it, but that because we're suffering and, well, deserving, I don't even like that. Deserving has nothing to do with it, with love or with forgiveness. But we do it because, you know, suffering, there is suffering, and the path is to end suffering. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
forgiveness is a challenging one for me. It's not something I really connect with, which is odd. I don't know why that is. I mean, as a practice, as an attitude, I completely connect with it. But yeah, anyway, thanks for that, Jonathan. Monica, hi.
When I, the first time I heard you talk about the 12-step God and that really it was karma, it blew my mind. But the more I thought about it for a long time, I mean, I kept studying and it got easier to wrap my mind around, not because I needed to, but it started to make sense. And I realized I had a lot of, I think you were just talking about judgment. I think I had some judgment to anyone who was going to stray away from the 12-step God that I've been taught for 2 decades. And so I feel like I had some attachment to it even. So that would be, so my question is, that's ego, in play. I mean, studying and what the Buddha was teaching is, you know, to stay in the moment. I mean, this has been really eye-opening, and I don't think I'm explaining it good, but I realized how much I wasn't staying in the moment, really, when I thought I was being, you know, and being present. I don't know, the question was about ego, but anyway.
I lost it.
You lost it? Me too.
No, try again. Yeah. Starting.
Okay, start well, was it my judgment or was it my attachment to being really, and then for a while I was really rigid if someone said, well, I don't believe in that way anymore, and I'd be really worried about them, like they were going to do. And but is it judgment or is it attachment?
Well, I'm not sure I'd say it's both, but it's all founded in fear. So, right, because we have this idea that we're comfortable with and that makes us feel safe. Okay, this is how reality works. Okay, good. It's good to know I'm safe, right? And then it's like something bumps up against that. There's a little crack in the glass, and you're like, oh no. Like, if reality isn't like that, then what is it? I'm gonna drink, I'm gonna die, you know. And so fear comes up, because we are attached to that idea, I mean, it, fear is involved in both sides, right? The fear of losing it, the fear of not knowing, you know, the human need to know, to feel that we know. It's why people made up stuff about reality over, I was talking about this recently, you know, about, like, you know, a couple thousand years ago, people just had a whole other view about reality. It's like, oh yeah, sure. There's a chariot that drags the sun across the sky every day. Sure, that's what it is. And it's like, people just make up things about reality because they can't live with the unknown. And there's that fear and that need to know. So, you know, the great Buddhist idea of don't know, practice don't know. Become comfortable with uncertainty. Ajahn Chah would, rather than using the word impermanence, he would use the term, he would say, it's uncertain. And becoming comfortable with uncertainty is a great way to live, because that's much closer to reality than any other certainty that we have. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was like bingo on the money. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Monica. Amy, hi.
Hi. Well, I guess I had a comment that seems a little bit related to both the first questions and maybe a question. I don't know. And there's a question in all of it. One, I've been thinking about the concept of no self. It seems like I've been thinking about it as one self in a way, because it feels like what they're talking about is sort of like not the way the way in which we are all connected. We're not separate from like nature or each other. And it seems to me like, or at least I want to believe her, that coming together point feels like a higher power, or a place that we kind of reach in loving awareness or in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was just, I'm kind of thinking about that. And I thought that Jonathan's questions about forgiveness kind of relates to that too, the way it's like, well, it is kind of what you said, like that it is about forgiving or having compassion for both, or is kind of the same thing in a way.
Yeah.
Or there is that lack of separation that helps us feel something bigger. But also, I guess the question, I know you also have to go. So, but the question is also sort of, I find that in my darkest moments, I have a much harder time connecting to that place. Like, it's not impossible.
Yes, of course. Yes,
right. And sure. I don't know what I'm saying about that exactly, but it's hard in terms of recovery. Like, those are the moments when I feel weakest in my recovery or, you know, and it's not like I really want to use, but I do in a way, like, or I feel like giving up on this whole thing, you know, which doesn't really look like using exactly, but it's just sort of like, anyway, so just kind of noting that, and I'm not sure if there's a question exactly, but anyway.
I think those are the moments when we have to really take refuge in the Sangha, especially in the community, and get help from others and connect with others.
Yeah.
And it's the times when we generally have to really emphasize self-care, which can be particularly difficult when we're feeling self-hatred.
Yeah.
And but that's why we need others at those moments. You know, we can't rely on our own, you know, self-will to like make it all work.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah. So I am going to go, I'm going to leave the meeting open. So if people want to hang out and share a bit with each other, you're welcome to. Monica will manage the meeting. And I thank you all. And I ask your forgiveness for leaving you.